Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Cenovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at cenovus.com.
Welcome to the Time of Monsters podcast, sponsored by The Nation magazine, and airing weekly on all podcasting platforms. Now, during periods when foreign policy and terrorism have greater salience, most notably after the 9/11 attack, civil rights often come under siege. We saw with the Patriot Act and various intense arguments about these sort of parameters of national security and civil liberties that came out of that. Now, in the wake of the October 7th attack launched by Hamas and Israel's war in Gaza, we're seeing a new period of ferment on these issues as college campuses across the United States are seeing protests, and there's a kind of robust international movement to raise the issue of Palestinian human rights, met often by strong opposition by governments and their allies. In that context, civil rights are once again and civil liberties are once again coming under the spotlight. And we are seeing this with the recent 11th hour renewal of Section 702 of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, commonly used and simply referred to as 702. And this both this renewal and the larger debates around civil liberties are like very much of the moment. And I'm very grateful to have three guests on who can talk about these with great pertinence. The two guests are Tom Durkin and Joe Ferguson, both distinguished lawyers. And I'm also joined by the journalist Doug Bell, who is often co-host on this podcast, and who will, I think, help guide us through this the morass of debate and contention around these issues. So first of all, gentlemen, thank you for taking the time to be here. And we'll also start with maybe Doug might have a few thoughts to open this.
Well, I mean, I'll be repeating slightly from Jeet's excellent introduction, just quickly to run through it. In mid-April, the United States House and Senate debated with, you know, considerable rhetorical flourish, 11th hour renewal of the Section 702 of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, FISA, or in the acronym-obsessed doublespeak endemic to congressional legislation, the Reforming Intelligence and Securing America Act. This act, known among the cognoscenti, as Jeet mentioned, simply as 702, was subsequently signed into law by Joe Biden very late on a Saturday night, minutes after passage in the Senate. Senate 702 sets out the restrictions, or more is the point, the lack thereof, on, among others, the FBI, the CIA, and the NSA's ability to listen and or read, and in the slightly creepy argot of the U.S. intelligence community, quote, U.S. person data, unquote. That, in more common parlance, is the content and of potentially every American's private emails, texts, and or phone calls. And the two guests, if I may just do a rather more formal introduction. Tom Durkin is managing partner at Durkin Roberts in Chicago, has 40 plus years experience in court fighting for and against the government of the United States, and particularly since 9/11, on behalf of its putative enemies. He's been described in the pages of the Wall Street Journal as one of the busiest national security lawyers in the United States. Notably, he was among a handful of American lawyers selected by the ACLU to be a civilian lawyer, helping with the military commissions in Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, where he represented alleged plotters in 9/11 attacks. Joe Ferguson is currently the president of the Civic Federation in Chicago, but he spent, more importantly for our discussion, he spent 15 years in the United States Attorney's Office for the Northern District of Illinois. 10 of those years were spent in that office's criminal division, prosecuting cases involving public corruption, mail wire fraud, tax fraud, terrorist financing, narcotics trafficking, and labor racketeering. He served as chief of the money laundering and forfeiture section, having been its deputy chief. He also held positions as deputy chief Financial Crimes and Special Prosecutions and USAO Terrorist Financing Coordinator. So, with all that having been said, I'm going to start by asking both of you, and you pick between you who you want to start us off. Let's start with Joe Ferguson. In a paragraph, why should Americans feel safer as a result of 702? And why, if at all, should they feel any less secure as a result?
Thanks for the lengthy bio. I think at bottom, Tom and I work as a tandem teaching national security law and founding the National Security Law Program, Civil Liberties Program at Loyola Law School. And so to your question, it basically brings together two worlds. Why should they feel more secure? They should feel more secure because we're actually capturing the information at the earliest possible point that may potentially signal some form of risk that exists relating to terrorism or things tangent to terrorism. And that capture at the earliest possible point is critically important because the nature of terrorism is the asymmetrical threat that exists, the asymmetrical harm that could come about by waiting too late. On the other side of the ledger, however, and this is why our program at Loyola is styled National Security and Civil Liberties, is they should not necessarily feel safer for two reasons. One is on the national security side, which is we collect way more information than we actually review. And then the question is, what is the consequence of that institutionally, programmatically? Are we sweeping too broadly, given the fact that the lack of focus by this sort of gigantic vacuum means that we're not distinguishing what matters as it's hitting our systems? The other side of it is all of this comes with not merely risk, but actual sort of encroachment of harms on civil liberties and our standards of privacy and our very constitutional culture. And in that respect, to the extent that that's the perception and in some way the reality, and the perception is the reality when nobody really understands what's going on, we're actually harming the legitimacy of our government and our trust in government, which itself is destabilizing over a long period of time. So there's benefits that are more transactional and justifiable in relation to asymmetrical harms coming from terrorism itself. But there is also kind of the boiling frog phenomenon of the undermining of the legitimacy of government from the ever creeping one-way ratchet encroachment of the government on our privacy.
Right. And Tom, can you weigh in at that in the same context?
Well, I think Joe's analysis is correct, and I like the boiling frog. I'm always reminded of in the old days when we used to have a Fourth Amendment in this country that had any meaning, and we would discuss the Fourth Amendment. People would always say, well, you know, I don't have anything to hide. What's the problem? And the answer always was, well, if you don't have anything to hide, why don't you just get an extra set of keys and leave it at the police station for the police? That's, in effect, that's what we've done, whether we know it or not. We now, we don't have locks on our doors anyway. We have cameras. We now have, you know, we've now given the keys to all our information to the government. And if that makes anybody feel secure, then good for them. It doesn't make me feel secure, but it's a very, very difficult process. I think the more troubling aspect to me is how there is a great public debate every time this is up for renewal. And for want of a better term, I think for your listeners that aren't familiar with it, it's called a warrantless surveillance program. And it's a complete contradiction to the Fourth Amendment, and everybody agrees with that. It's just it's one of the exceptions. And there's always a strong effort by civil rights people to modify it. And every year there's a great debate, and this year it really looked like it was going to get modified. It looks like it's going to get modified every time it's up for renewal. And somehow we could discuss how our theories on why this happens, but you know, somehow it's always the 11th hour, always gets renewed, just like, you know, Joe Biden signed it at the last minute. I think it's a demonstration of how powerful the national security state has become. Now, who that national security state is a good question, too.
But one thing that really struck me, and I'd like to hear from both of you on this, is on this issue about the extent to which the rhetoric that goes on around what is a pretty complex discussion in the House and the Senate as regards renewal. The distance between the rhetoric and anything like what's really going on, notwithstanding what you were saying, Joe, about its substantive benefits, you know, in terms of keeping terrorists at bay and fentanyl and all the rest of it. But there was one moment that really struck me, which was that it's very rare that there's any actual back and forth debate on the Senate floor. And John Cornyn and Durbin at one point actually were exchanging ideas on this subject. Here's the thing that struck me. One was that Dick Durbin said, for the record, this comes dangerously close to an actual debate on the floor of the United States Senate. You'd better call your friends. That's what he said. But the distance between Cornyn's observation of it as strictly 702 gives the NSA, CIA, FBI the ability to listen to foreign actors, and then Durbin sort of on the other side saying, "Well, hang on, that's not really true. That everybody gets swept up in this." And this distance between the two realms, it's really, you know, and I say this somewhat as a Canadian. I mean, I was just stunned by it. So I'll leave that open for either of you to comment.
So, Tom, I'll jump in here and a little bit of a pivot off of your remarks in response to what Doug is putting on the table here, which is this time around, it was actually different. There were four separate proposals, amendment proposals, that were on the floor this time. And it involved members from both sides of the aisle in both houses, or you know, the Senate and the House. And there was a form of kind of truncated discussion that almost passed for debate. The problem, and frankly, what you have is the pushing of the national security sort of terrorism imperative in broad brush from a fairly diverse group of legislators now who appreciate that it comes with consequences and there are some guardrails and lane dividers that we can put on this. There are some circuit breakers that we can put on this that actually keeps us in the same position of strength and knowing with respect to the threat, while mitigating the actual impact on privacy rights. And the most particular thing, and there were multiple versions of it, was a warrant requirement if you were going to mine and actually pull the content of information from calls that involved an American speaker, a U.S. person, right? And that is what was tantalizingly close here because there were different versions of it. One version said, okay, we acknowledge everything's going to be swept up. And technologically, we sweep it up just before it comes into the country. So it's really not subject completely to the Constitution in the same way. We've created 702 that kind of opens the door to this capacity for, you know, a year, right? With very, very, very few restrictions. One measure said, you don't search it at all without a warrant if you are searching anything that connects up to an American. Another version of it said that you can go and actually get the metadata to understand whether or not there is a pattern of calls around words of significance that involve American actors. And then at that point, if you want to go deep dive into the content, you got to get a warrant. So they actually were talking about this. And which one would be sort of the version that had guardrails and circuit breakers? And that's what fell apart. And part of the reason that it fell apart, and this is the real shame right now, and this is why we should be concerned, is Congress, because of its polarization, And because of the way that we actually discuss these things, because of the polarization, to your point, the distance between Cornyn and Durbin, is that the Congress itself is actually not performing its legislative oversight function here to put the guardrails and circuit breakers on the executive at a time when we are not in an emergency situation, when we actually could be having the reasonable debate.
Tom, I'd love to hear what you have to
say. I want to ask Tom about that, to build on that, because I think, Tom, earlier you had referred to this idea of like there's a state of exception or, you know, that justifies this. And it's very curious that, you know, even though we had October 7th and all this stuff going on, this is actually not an emergency in America. This is like a foreign policy stuff that's going on. But and it is relatively, for the United States, a period of calm. And one would think that the state of exception that came after 9/11 was over and you could have that sort of constitutional deliberation is actually required in a republic. So it's, I'm very curious to know why, you know, the state of exception seems to be continuing.
Well, if you read Carl Schmitt, it continues all the time. And some people...
Yeah, the state of the exception is the norm.
For the listeners that don't know what we're talking about, Carl Schmitt, in his famous book, Political Theology, sums it all up, the first sentence of the book. It reads something to the effect of, sovereign is he who gets to state the exception. And there's a lot of debate in academic circles, which I enjoy, saying, you know, do we have a rule of law or are we ruled by law? And is the rule by law by the state of exception? And there are some people who say it is only ruled by law. And that's our class at Loyola is kind of based on a seminar format. And when we throw that out to our students, it becomes rather eye-opening to them that, you know, and as I tell them, I hope they learn it quicker than I did, thinking that I was going to spend my life defending the rule of law and finding out that we're really ruled by law. But it's an amazing phenomenon. I mean, there really wasn't an exception in my mind after 9/11 either. If you grant the exception after 9/11, there's no way that it can be continuing now. You know, Guantanamo still opens. You know, this is a country that doesn't mind the exception whatsoever. The other theme of what we talk about in our class is the two-tiered system of justice. You know, does this create a two-tier system? Because, you know, we have one standard for our normal criminal prosecutions, and then we have this other standard with the terrorism exception that is replete with exceptions the whole time, beginning with the way the evidence is gathered, with classified evidence, you know, and it's, I think, a frightening proposition.
And if I could jump in here, I mean, Jeet, you're spot on, and to what Tom's saying, this is the existential question that we try to sort of bring law students into. It's a permanent state of exception. Tom's written a law review article precisely on that topic. It's a permanent state of exception when we're talking about terrorism or the threat of terrorism, which obviously is a fear-based thing. So it becomes very primal, but it's also why in my initial remarks, I use the term one-way ratchet. There are periods after a great perceived emergency, 9/11, where we all take our hands off of the wheel and just leave it to the sovereign to decide what needs to be done. Around 2004, 2005, when there was great reporting from the Washington Post and the New York Times and Carol Rosenberg, who was with Miami Herald at the time, we started to learn about Guantanamo. We started to learn about the sorts of things that were being done at Abu Ghraib, that there was this revulsion, and Congress was part of the revulsion and the reaction. And there was a swing back of the pendulum where we tried to capture within a legal system how these powers should work. But it never swings back all the way to where we started. The fulcrum has moved, and the fulcrum is always moving. And in that sense, it's a one-way ratchet. We internalize those exceptions as a new norm. They're sort of embodied in legalisms, sort of statutory frameworks. Barack Obama ran for president saying he would close Guantanamo. It was constitutionally an abomination. And then, because he is a constitutional a lawyer, he actually created a rubric that created the justifications under the law, the legalisms under the law for the continuation, because no president cedes back power to the people. We move in one direction. And so the exception becomes normalized, and then it's an iterative process.
Just on that point about the one-way ratchet, though, I mean, it's intriguing to me given that image, which I think is of the one-way ratchet, which is terrific. I'm really struck by this. I was struck by the fact that, for instance, that the Biggs Amendment, which was the most sort of the clearest of the four, as from what I could read, which suggested your what you got into previously, Joe, about, you know, that it would require a warrant, and that vote was 212 to 212 in the House. Now, notwithstanding Tom's excellent analysis, 212 to 212 is pretty damn close. And that suggests a momentum. I mean, those 212 people are voting for different reasons. There's four different classifications that I'm aware of. There's hardcore, burn it all down conservatives, libertarians. But still, even at that, 112 to 212 suggests that there is a residual commitment to certain kinds of constitutional principles. Now, then the question becomes, how do you fire that up? How does that gain momentum and become the substantive?
I think the 212 to 212, and I think it's a great point for conversation. The 212 to 212, and maybe Tom will think I'm being a little Pollyanna-ish here, and he's right. At some level, is the 212 to 212 is representative of the fact that over time, there's become an elevated consciousness about what we're actually doing and the consequences of what we're doing, which is why Jeet's observation that the time that we're living in is not a time of real emergency in the United States is really an important one. That's the time when we should all be able to sort of calmly look at this. I will tell you, the idea of a 212 to 212 vote on this tells me that we are ripe for the full conversation. And but for the fact of the mishigas that's going on with the leadership of the House and the Speaker of the House, we actually would have had a moderating amendment that would have provided some circuit breakers. We are that close. That, from a hopeful perspective, from the Pollyannish perspective, says people are kind of getting it.
Well, if I could jump in on that, though, I point the finger at the courts first. I don't think we should have had to wait for a 212 to 212 political solution or anything else. There's one of the earliest topics we discuss in our class, in the national security class, is this whole idea of deferring to the executive in matters of national security. And that's kind of established Supreme Court precedent now. But it's an easy way out for judges. You know, I frequently say that the whole problem with the war on terror is that it's an ass covering contest and that the whole issue that boils down to no one from the FBI agent to his supervisor, to the U.S., the assistant U.S. attorney, to the U.S. attorney, to the magistrate judge, to the federal district judge, to the, circuit court judge in the Seventh Circuit. No one wants to be the person to say that was unconstitutional, let this guy go. And then that guy goes down into the subway with a suicide belt on and blows up the subway. And if you want to know, in my opinion, you know, the heart of the war on terror, that's what it's all about. Nobody wants to do that. And that gets into more of an esoteric discussion than I think we need to at the moment. You know, the real question is, you know, can you really do preventative prosecutions, you know, in the criminal justice system? Joe mentioned earlier that, you know, we're safer in the sense that we have all this information and so on. But because of the ass covering contest rule, in my opinion, you know, what do we do with it? What we do, in my observation, is we end up arresting a lot of 18-year-old kids when they turn 18 who've been on the internet from the age 15 talking nonsense and getting hooked up with informants and getting involved in ISIS and so on. And it's really, I mean, most, with all due respect to the government's war on terror, most of the prosecutions I've defended in the war on terror are nonsensical. They're very minor threats. You know, these are usually kids that are very mentally unbalanced and so forth. Now, that's not to say they have not stopped threats and anything else, but it's a different position when you start putting that into the criminal justice system, and then you have judges saying, "Oh, well, that's okay. I have to defer to the national, because of national security, the courts don't have the expertise in that. We have to defer to the executive." But Joe, you were trying to say something.
Yeah, in all of that, I think if in calm, quiet, confidential, sort of safe setting, you were to ask people, if we were to describe the system that we've set up and the consequences, including the consequences to privacy and so on and so forth, if you were to ask people, is this the country that you want to live in? Most of them would say no. And you ask those very same people, do you want to take the risk of terrorist attacks? They would say no. And therein lies the conundrum, right?
Right.
Like, what are we going to do about it? And so we err on the side of fear. And this is part of what we teach at times, and this is not to denigrate the motivations of those who are actually manning the machinery of the national security state, if you will. The fact of the matter is within the culture of government, agencies exist at some sort of level of consciousness to continue to exist. Mm. And in that sense, you have to come up with justifications that will support your next budget request or an increase to your budget. And then that gets you into some of the sorts of situations that Tom is talking about.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, that sort of civil liberties abuse is a kind of a long history. I mean, I like, if you look at, you know, back in the Cold War era, you know, J. Edgar Hoover would justify the FBI budget with the sort of threat of communism. And as communism went into steep decline domestically in the United States, you know, it became a situation where, like, you know, like 10 or 15% of members of the Communist Party were FBI agents. And if Hoover needed to, you know, go to Congress, he would just send in more agents and say, look, the number of communists is rising. And so it does seem like a lot of this stuff that the FBI, that Tom described, is a kind of make-work project. Find a, you know, mentally ill kid who seems to be Googling about ISIS and, you know, like, set up a years-long system to entrap them, wait until they turn 18. At some point, you know, you got to ask, like, how does that, I mean, if the fundamental premise is we're serving national security for saving us from terrorism, like, I look at these cases and I actually find it hard to understand how, you know, like, you are actually fighting terrorism by doing this.
Well, I think that's a good question. What the question that it begs is, and the question that really is on the table now, and I'm not sure that enough people are paying attention, is the whole issue of domestic terrorism. That's the new twist here. You know, a lot of the exceptions that were justifiable for international surveillance and so forth all fell under the rubric of an exception for international terrorism. You know, that's what 9/11 was about. That was non-state international actors doing terrorist attack. Now, the focus, in my view, seems to be shifting towards domestic terrorism. And I know from experience that the FBI has long sought a domestic terrorism statute. There is no criminal domestic terrorism statute. There's no crime of domestic terrorism. There is a definition of domestic terrorism in the criminal code, but that's for sentencing enhancement purposes. And the FBI has a has an interest, and for years now they've been trying to get it. I don't know exactly where it is, but I think there's still a pending bill now. There usually is, about trying to get a domestic terrorism statute, and the effect of that will be to give the FBI the first choice on any investigation of what it perceives to be domestic terrorism. And I think you mentioned early on, Doug, about, you know, the student protests and so forth now that are going on after October 7th. I see that as a real dangerous threat today with respect to what's happening. They're labeling a lot of what happened on the campus as domestic terrorist acts. That's a scary bomb to be throwing around a small room. I mean, the real threat, and we discussed this in our class, is that if the domestic, unfortunately, that statute seemed that the law and the enactment of that domestic terrorism statute always seems to get defeated, which is a credit to the Congress. But the danger there is, will we then be required to set up domestic FISA? Are we then going to have a FISA, domestic FISA court? Are we then going to have a national security court? And I think the answer to all of that is ultimately, if that statute gets enacted, that's what will happen sooner or later. You know, as I always say in class, you know, kiss it goodbye. I mean, what's left of civil liberties will be completely kissed goodbye if that happens. If we end up with a national security court in this country, forget about it.
Yeah.
I don't want to be the guy crying wolf, but I'm not the only person who, and you know, a lot of people far smarter than I are saying the same thing, that we better be careful of what happens here.
You know, I'm reminded of the British Prime Minister Macmillan's great line about, you know, how do you manage under difficult circumstances? And he says, I don't manage at all. It's all about events, right? And events, my dear boy, events. To that point, if I could ask Joe, these circuit breakers that you're talking about with regards to enforcing a warrant, which I think they've only reinstated 702 for 2 years.
Right.
And so there is going to be some kind of debate ongoing.
Yep.
Notwithstanding the fact that, you know, shit happens and it maybe gets blown out of the water. If that's introduced, does that start the warrant? I mean, specifically the warrant as the circuit breaker. Does that then drive the conversation in all of these other areas? For instance, Tom's talking about the courts. Is that the you know, the first domino that then really opens up the conversation?
It certainly is, depending on which game of dominoes you want to talk about, it actually is the first domino. So the next thing that would be implicated is folks would say, okay, great, we have a warrant requirement. What's the threshold requirement? Is it on a level that our traditional Fourth Amendment constitutional principles require, or is it at a degraded standard? And let's talk about the FISA court itself, the court that is Article III judges specially appointed as a secondary assignment to be on this foreign intelligence surveillance court. And the critique of them is historically they approve just about everything that comes before them, right? And so then the question is, okay, so what's going on there? I have my view. Tom probably has, and you guys each will have your view of it. I've seen how it works. And as a matter of sort of general operation, this is something of the family jewels for the intelligence and national security community. And so they don't mess around with it. They actually do it to a fairly well, albeit under this degraded second tier standard of probable cause. But they do it to a fairly well because they do not want judges actually saying no. Right. Because then that starts to cause questions about what this is all about and what the government's trying to do. However, in times of emergency, the standards get a little softer. And it's because of that giant ass covering contest that Tom is referring to. Nobody wants to be the one to say no that actually leads to a situation where there is some horrible event that occurred because the government wasn't able to track. But to your point, that first, okay, we are going to add an additional warrant requirement that's a safeguard for Americans. Is it sufficient? Because it's going to a court that always says yes. It to many people, they look and it's just sort of the matador and the bull ring with the red cape and off the bull goes.
Right.
And so on and so forth. And then behind all of it is, what's the tracking and accountability measures? What's the reporting back to Congress? How much actual digging in is there being done on what these warrants are to whom? I will tell you that the government has drawn way back on a lot of its activity in terms of drawing on Section 702 originated information. However, the next emergency or the door opener that is domestic terrorism may put us back into this world where, you know, we're in free fall again, essentially from a civil liberties perspective. So the dominoes of a conversation, we have to make sure that that is the first domino of a whole series of conversations rather than a one and done saying, okay, we've done the job.
I want to talk a little bit about the general politics of this and what you guys sort of sense, because it is true that you have a sort of bipartisan opposition to, or, you know, concern about the FISA and a desire to push back, and, you know, especially among the more libertarian Republicans, the more anti-government Republicans, which are in some ways the more extreme Republicans are better than the moderate Republicans, like the and among the Democrats who have their own constituencies for civil liberties. So, like, is it just a matter of the House leadership being messed up and not being able to, like, pull this together? Or is there, like, what's a political process where you create that coalition that you know, goes from 212 to, you know, 230, 240? Like, what do you guys think? Like, is this a coalition that can be expanded in any ways?
The actual public debate changes the dynamics, and that's why Dick Durbin's remark is a really well taken one.
Yeah.
Good Lord, what would happen if we actually discussed it?
Yeah,
because, you know, that 212 to 212 situation, you know, people have different degrees of information. They have different elements of motivation. Some of them political. Some of them have really dug in and done the work. Others haven't done the work and are just following instructions. But once you have an open, extended legislative debate about this, I think all of the deck chairs on the Titanic then get moved around all over again. And then we have to look and see, you know, how much, as to this issue, the political ideological spectrum is less a line and more a circle and how they connect up, right? But that is what you're calling out here, Jeet, is these things do not fall into the usual binaries of politics. Because there actually is somewhere in our DNA, from different perspectives, this awareness that there's something important that's going on here in addition to the national security piece. But then it's the environment and the events that end up being a huge driver, to Doug's point.
I just want to ask Tom to weigh in here, especially in the context of these prosecutions that are likely forthcoming. With these students that are getting hauled up, both subject to civil lawsuits, but with these kind of strange terrorist enhancements, and then, you know, the inevitable prosecutions that'll carry on through the fall. I'm just wondering if you think that this, the possibility of a different kind of discussion will ameliorate the problems that those students are going to face.
Well, it might, but I think the issue with the students is again back to this domestic terrorism issue. From my vantage point, I think what I'm seeing happening is that there's a tremendous movement afoot to contradict the national security policy of the United States right now. And that's a serious threat to in an election year. And I think what's happening is that there are motivations to call them domestic terrorists or influenced by outside agitators. That's always the trope that is used when, you know, it couldn't just be well-informed, educated students who might be right. It has to be outside agitators or anarchists that are, you know, threatening to pull down the whole edifice. Empire. You know, I think that's what's going on. And, I don't get a lot of comfort in, you know, like the January 6th case, I think, is a really significant prosecution. As I tell people, you know, I've spent most of my life, other than the years I was a federal prosecutor, defending against the government. I don't get great comfort in rooting for the government to save the republic. You don't usually look to the Department of Justice and the prosecutors to save you. Now, and I don't mean that demeaningly either. That's not their role. But to end up, I think this, again, it's this threat of domestic terrorism that's in the air. I think that's part of the reason that some of the MAGA Republicans are in line with some of the progressive Democrats on the whole issue the surveillance. Because God forbid, there's the great line, always the great line of, you know, one man's freedom fighter is another man's terrorist. And, you know, they consider themselves freedom fighters. That's a debate we could go down that for another 45 minutes. The whole issue on the table is, who's in charge? You know, is this really the deep state that is driving this whole conversation? And who's the deep state? And you and I mentioned earlier, Doug, in a private conversation about Michael Glennon's book on double government, talking about the Trumanites and the Madisonians. The one thing Michael's, it's a great book, and Michael is a tremendous thinker. And the one thing he insists upon is that whether, you know, they may fight all day in private, but in public they have to agree with each other, or they may make it look like they're all on the same team. That doesn't happen anymore. Donald Trump took that veil away, and we're in dangerous times because of that. And I think that's a serious, real serious issue in terms of the whole political debate, because there's constant talk these days about how there's no faith left in our institution. And, you know, good cause to have that thought. You know, people are very critical of the Supreme Court these days, rightly so, I think. The impasse we have in Congress, notwithstanding the 212, these are dangerous times, and dangerous times lead to states of exception.
Yeah. Well, this gives me a good leeway to return to something that Joe had said earlier, which I kind of want to return to, because that issue of legitimacy. And I thought Joe made a really great point about how, like, in some ways, the sort of, you know, giving the government the sort of exceptional power, especially in a culture like the United States, where you have people, you know, across the political spectrum who, for very good reasons, don't trust the government and you know, like, are very suspicious of arbitrary power, that in itself feeds a lack of legitimacy. That makes people even more suspicious. And, like, is there anyone within that sort of, you know, government circles, not politicians, but within the administrative class, who, like, have any sense of awareness that by doing this power grab, by, you know, like, asserting, you know, like, a permanent state of exception, they are itself endangering the very system that they claim to protect? Like, does the type of argument that Jill made, do you guys have any sense if that has any resonance among the administrative class? Do they even think about the unintended consequences of getting what they want?
The think tanks and institutions of higher education are filled with people who come from that administrative class, who mm-hmm. then have the conversation that we're having. But in the context of doing the job in real time, that may be a dinner party with their friends, but that's not their job. There is not a a special working group on government legitimacy that's calling, you know, convening meetings to have conversations about, you know, how close we are to going completely off the rails on the legitimacy front. Fortunately, you know, Tom's point, not the government's job to save us, or the Justice Department's job to save us. They have a very specific task. And unfortunately, yeah, that's how the administrative state works, is everybody has their specific job. You would like to think that there is somebody who actually has the holistic view. Most of them have that in the back of their mind. That's not their job. And as a consequence, there is, in some respect, a susceptibility, if you will, to who we decide to actually be the person at the top of the food chain.
Well, but the people that have that job are the courts.
Well, there's that. Yeah,
that's the job of the courts, and you know, it's like you can't expect the Department of Justice to do it all. You can't expect Congress to do it all, but you should be able to demand it of the courts. And I think that's why, just as of recent, you know, these clown Republicans standing outside a courthouse in New York calling the delegitimacy of the whole process.
Of the judiciary.
I mean, yeah. Of the judiciary. Yeah. That's a dangerous game. I mean, mm-hmm. if we don't have the courts, it's ridiculous. And I think the courts have been abdicating, as I said earlier, for a long time. And what always amazes me is that in the federal system, at least, I mean, you might expect that out of elected judges who want to get reelected. But what amazes me is federal judges have lifetime appointment for that very reason, so that they are not subject to those types of political winds. And they're supposed to call them as they see them. And I think the public is exactly right that they're seeing that is not happening anymore. It's just not happening. It hasn't happened at all in the war on terror. The fact that the courts of the United States have permitted Guantanamo to remain open is an international disgrace. But one example. You go into a litany of all the areas that they've abdicated responsibility from. But it's what when you see supposedly representatives of the people of this republic standing outside a courtroom saying this is a rigged court, this is all rigged, then you got to go, wow, what's going to happen? Is it okay?
How do we come back from that?
I don't know that you do. And that's what's scaring me.
Yeah.
Well, that's a kind of a dark topic, maybe an appropriate one to end this on, because we are kind of, I often feel these days, we're staring into the abyss. But in looking into the abyss, I don't think I could have had any better guides than the guests that we've had. I want to thank Joe Ferguson and Tom Durkin and my co-host Doug Bell. I mean, I think one big takeaway I have is that there's been a, you know, systematic failure, as Tom was pointing out, in the courts, as Joe pointed out, the sort of dysfunction of Congress, and perhaps in the Republic, one's ultimate hope has to be in the people, that if enough people, you know, get involved and agitated to think about an issue, you can perhaps like reverse some of the systematic failures. And on that note, I want to again not just thank the guests, but also point out that they are playing a key role in raising public awareness of these crucial issues, which are, for the sake of the United States, really existential questions. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Cenovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at cenovus.com.